Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe.
I'm Heather Mason.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Foolish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And today we have one special guest who's going to talk about fee-free football. Yes, football for juniors where they're not going to have to pay a cent to play. That's what we really wanted to hear for a long time. And that will be Gary Shorto who we'll be talking to. But I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And it's good to be back, John. It's been a while.
It has been. You've been away.
I was in Turkmenistan, yes, doing the 5th Asian Indoor and Martial Arts Games, which was quite an experience, I have to say.
Well, not everybody gets the opportunity to visit Turkmenistan and let alone call sport there. Bit different than home?
Very different, yes. We had a government official inside the truck monitoring what went to air. We were monitored as what was being said, and in one game we even had them telling our guys in the graphics department not to change the score. So Turkmenistan were 3-0 down, and when the fourth goal went in, the score didn't change, and it turned out it was actually a government official telling our graphics people not to change the score.
How's your Turkmeni language-wise?
I know. Only know a few words like "govormi," which is "how are you."
That's a good one to know.
And "sabol" is "thank you."
Apparently, the most needed word in that country is "niet." Is that correct?
We had a lot of that. Yeah, there's security guards saying no, and people having photographs deleted off their mobile phones, and basically you're barred from going in certain directions. And the thing was, every day it was different. So we'd start driving to the stadium and then the road was closed. So we had to go a different way. And then the next day that road would be closed and we'd have to go back the other way.
But, you know, it doesn't matter what political regimes are in control of countries or all that sort of stuff that's going on at that level. But the people, wherever you go, people are the same everywhere, aren't they?
Oh, people were amazing, yeah. I mean, it was. I met some really, really lovely guys and girls as well. And, you know, I think one of the most special things was one day we had the Turkmenistan commentators next to us, and a lot of them were young students. And one day this guy came, and they have one of their sort of traditional foods is they put a lot of meat in bread, or they put onions in bread and do that. So it's a very bread-based sort of food. And he goes, "Oh, look, have one of these. My mum made it." And I was going, no, it's okay. He goes, no, I want you to have it. So I had this thing that his mum made, and it was absolutely beautiful. It was fantastic.
Nothing like mama's cooking.
Absolutely not. But while I was there, one of the things, this is going to be my topic of conversation, because I was at those games and just, you know, I had a week back home, and before that I was at the Southeast Asian Games. And the thing that kind of worries me a little bit is how sport now is really being used to sort of drive up a nationalistic fervour, and being used not sort of propaganda, but if we think back, and maybe I'm going to too far an extreme, but the 1936 Berlin Olympics, where again it was to promote that healthy Germanic Aryan breed, this perfection. I don't think it's going down that path. But in Malaysia, we saw this, the immense pride, obviously, when they won the gold medals. And I don't have a problem with that. But, you know, people were wearing the national colours. The national flag was everywhere. It was a real, real push about nationalism. And then when they achieved their gold medal tally that had been put on them by the government, they were given a public holiday. And we saw the same things almost in Turkmenistan. There was this fervour was built up around their national team, around their national athletes. And then when they didn't achieve or whatever, the disappointment was massive. It was unbelievable to see some of these fans who were distraught because their athletes didn't deliver. Now, obviously, the reverse of that was when they did deliver, the celebrations were wild, they were crazy, there was ecstatic, you know, behaviour. Which, again, that's great because sport is an emotional thing. But I do think that some of the realistic expectations have been stretched. But what worries me probably the most is in both of these games, there were a lot of sports that were subjective in their voting. Now, therefore, you know, it was down to judges giving marks, say for a synchronized diving or even for gymnastics. And I worry, because there were so many of those, that these are sports that can be influenced. Now, there was one of the events, and I'm not going to say which particular games it was, where the athlete complained and said, "No, I won," to the judges, walked over, refused to leave the arena saying, I won, I should get the gold medal. The judges then went into the TV truck, watched it again, reversed their decision, and this athlete got gold. Now, to me, that is just completely wrong. It should not happen. That's not what international sport is about. It's not about those events. But there's too many subjective sports, I believe, that are now being influenced by host nations or whatever to get their medal tallies up, to create that nationalistic fervour and all of that. And I really worry about that. And I tend to feel that for some of these sporting events, we need to look at that and we need to limit the amount of subjective sports there are, where voting is done on subjectiveness. And I mean, the other thing, obviously, with both of these events is the host nation gets to choose some of the sports. So you saw in Malaysia a lot of sports where they were never going to win medals just didn't happen this time around. They were axed. So women's boxing, for example, there wasn't any because Malaysia were never going to win any medals in that. So they were axed. And the Philippines, who had, I think it was, won 4 of the 6 medals in the women's boxing, one of their boxers having won a gold at the Olympics, I think, or she certainly medaled at the Olympics, but she'd won 4 Southeast Asian gold medals. She was just there as a spectator because, you know, Malaysia decided, no, we're not going to have that because we won't win anything there. Again, I think that's possibly wrong as well.
Well, Ashley, it was Samuel Johnson way back in the 1700s who said that patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. Make of that what you will. What do you say when countries do that? I don't think you have to go back to 1936 either. I think we can look back, say, 1980, 84, if you're talking about Olympic Games and the way that nationalism or patriotism can influence what goes on at a particular sporting event.
Could we say 2000? Let's remember Johnny Howard was everywhere, popping up in his tracks.
Yeah.
But I don't think it was. To me, it didn't feel like that. It didn't. I mean, I think Australians were very proud to have the Olympics, but I don't think we actually had that same. There wasn't that fervour and that desperation to be the best. And
I reckon about that time, Australia has around a population at that time of around 20 million people. I reckon there are only 20 million people on the globe that weren't sick to death of Aussie, 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 oi, oi, oi. The whole world was sick
of that for 30 years.
But getting back to that, even during that Sydney Olympic period, there was a sense that when the walker, who was disqualified, you know, there was this national pride was hurt when she was disqualified. You know, that official that pulled our Aussie racer out, you know, that was not on as far as the general population were concerned, and many people were upset about that and saw it as a fix. Yeah, but international sport needs nationalism and patriotism to thrive.
I agree with that, but I think we have to be very careful with it, because I remember when we went to the World Cup in Germany in 2006, having a really interesting conversation with some Germans there, and they were very concerned to be hosting this event, because after what had happened with the Second World War, they said they had nationalistic fervour being very much pushed to the background, tried to be controlled because they didn't want it to ever get out of hand again. And so they were very cautious about it. I think what I'm trying to say here is I think that if we've got an IOC and we have these bodies, they need to be very cautious about it as well, because I do feel that it is at a point in some places where it could tip over and get into a very dangerous area. My biggest thing that I'm advocating here and what I'm talking about here on Not the Footy Show is I would like to see a limit to sports that are subjective, that the voting is where you don't have a clear winner. So, you know, if you have a boxing match, usually, boxing is a bad one.
Yeah, you are picking the wrong one.
Okay, but let's say then a game of hockey or a game of football or even a game of badminton or a game of squash, there is a scoring system and you know who the winner is because the scoring system is very, very clear, and it is clear who the winner is. I think they need to be very careful, and I think there should be a limit as to how many of these sports that are based on subjective scoring are permitted in games.
Well, boxing's had a long history of nationalistic type decisions being made, hasn't it?
Yeah, on boxing, I mean, to be honest, I commentated both the semi-finals and the finals, and there was a diabolical decision in the semi-finals of the boxing. And, I mean, it was clear that the Singapore boxer won by a country mile. And interestingly, the flaw in his opponent that he picked up in the second round, come the gold medal match, the opponent picked it up in the first round. And I think the fight was stopped in the second round. So, you know, it was, yeah. Boxing, and I was emceeing actually an event at the weekend, and, you know, we were discussing how boxing needs to sort out its scoring. It needs to find a way to make it clearer so that, again, as we've discussed before, when you have these big fights on TV and then you have CompuBox comes up and goes, so-and-so threw more punches than the other one.
Yeah.
But it's not about who threw the most punches. It's about winning each round. You know, it's not about punches. Maybe the boxing should look at that. Maybe if that's the way it has to go, it should consider that no longer do we do it round by round, that it is ultimately at the end of the fight who threw the most punches. But then, of course, it comes down to, did those punches land cleanly, or did they get brushed off a forearm or off a glove? You know, it's a very difficult one.
Oh, and a bloke could be capable, or a woman these days, obviously, could be capable of throwing lots and lots and lots of punches really quickly that have no power to them, that don't even actually hurt you. So, you know, there's lots of little nuances there that you've got to try and figure out in the scoring system, don't you?
Absolutely.
And it's interesting because we've mentioned the Olympic Games, and FIFA are the same in the sense that they walk into a government. If a government bids for an Olympic Games or a FIFA World Cup or something like that, there's a great big book that governments have to abide by to host these games. So these are organisations with a tremendous amount of power, that they dictate tax codes and legislation to companies. You know, they generate tax breaks for their sponsors, and countries actually change legislation to allow these sporting events to go ahead. Now, it's up to those organisations to ensure that those governments aren't using their sport to promote and propagate themselves through the avenues that you're talking about.
Totally agree. I absolutely agree 100%. And I think, again, if you look at it, though, the fact that only two nations were prepared to bid for the next two Olympics after Japan,
yeah.
Where are the Olympics headed? I think the Olympic Games, I don't want to see them die, but I think they've become too big, too cumbersome. But that's a discussion for another day.
Hi, I'm Gordon Banks, and I'm listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed. And I was very pleased to see a bit of fake news because it was announced that Gordon Banks had passed away. And then I was like, I can't believe that. And then it was fake news. But I don't know why those people... Why do people do this?
Why would you pick on poor Gordon to fake news him? Honestly, that's just bizarre.
Yeah, it was very sad. But the next bit of our guest is not fake news. This is very, very real.
Yeah, it's a good story.
And as you know, we've been questioning the fees to play football for a very, very long time. The cost in this state has gone up to ridiculous levels for any young children that want to play the game of football. And it's becoming that you have to have money to play what was always classed as the working man's game. And one club that's looking to correct that imbalance is Balga Soccer Club, and they're looking to put forward fee-free football for their juniors. Now, obviously, hearing that news, we wanted to find out more information about it, so we caught up with Gary Shorto. Gary Shorto, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks for having me, Ashley.
Well, the reason we're catching up with you is because Balga have done a really special thing, Balga Soccer Club, in that they're now offering juniors football for free, a fee-free program. Can you tell us what the thinking was behind this development?
So the main thinking is to get kids active and to give everyone the opportunity to play this game that we love, and we want to see more and more kids participating in the sport, and we don't think that whether you have money in behind you should be a factor as to whether or not you play. So that's where it grew from, and then it was just to figure out a way to make it work.
I mean, that obviously is the next big question, is how are you going to make it work? Because if you do have junior football programs, you've still got costs attributed to that in terms of strips, coaching, you know, the administration, etc.
Yeah, 100%. The basis that we're working off is active members, basically. So if you play football for free, then you have to be an active member. An active member, we see, is someone that contributes to the club. So there is a volunteering side to everyone's participation. And then also, you know, helping out in fundraising, selling raffle tickets and the like. Throughout the year is how we see we're going to make it sustainable. So active members is the big one, and then obviously sponsorship on top of that.
Yeah, I was going to ask. Sorry to interrupt. I was going to ask about sponsorship. I mean, you know, how much is that contributing to the pot?
Well, we're hopeful that it'll be a big step in terms of sponsorship. Now, we found it hard over the last few years to get sponsors because obviously it is tough times out there. But we're hoping that people see the benefit of being involved or associated with a great program like this that gets kids active. So we're really hopeful that's going to be a major driving force behind it.
I mean, I've spoken to a lot of sponsors of various sporting organisations, and most of them have said they're not sponsors these days, they're donors, in that they get very little return. But I would have thought that this would attract a lot of sponsors because they will know that their money is going to a good cause and it's giving young children an opportunity.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what we believe in as well. The whole basis and the whole drive behind it is, you know, to make this game grow and not to always put your hand out for handouts through parents who obviously might be struggling themselves. So the more we can do behind the scenes in terms of sponsorship, the better it is for everyone.
I mean, you've touched on a few things there that I think are really interesting points. I mean, we've seen in football, not only in WA, but across the country, the junior fees have just gone up to ridiculous prices and have almost made the sport exclusive, as you touched on, to people with money. Is this a case of trying to return it to the man on the street?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we live in an area of WA that, you know, isn't as affluent as other areas around the place. And there's some kids here that are unbelievable footballers. And why should they not have the opportunity to play because their parents don't have enough money to pay these NPL clubs thousands of dollars? It's ridiculous. They should be given the opportunity to progress as far as they can. And that's what we're hoping to achieve.
I mean, potentially, you could end up with a lot of children coming to play at your club, you know, far more than you've got at the moment. And you've got a big junior program there already. Are you able to cope with that if the floodgates do open?
Well, obviously, there is a cap to the amount that we can take. And that's obviously area more so than anything else. You know, obviously having the space to be able to train that many kids and to play that many kids on the Sunday. So we have got a good relationship with the city of Stirling, and we've already expressed or talked about other areas that we might be able to utilise if things do go through the roof that we're hoping it does.
Well, what's the sort of feedback been from the parents who've already got children at the club?
Oh, I absolutely love it. Everyone's really... I don't think I've heard a negative comment from a parent yet. So, everyone loves the idea. Everyone's very excited about the new season. So, I think it's only been positive so far.
And are they happy to get involved, as you say, in terms of selling raffle tickets and being probably participating more in the club and making it more of what... I'm an old guy, so I mean, make it more of what clubs were all about, where it was a community.
Well, that's exactly the other point. Everyone's time poor, and everyone is money poor. So you got to look at ways to work around those factors. And we think, you know, if we can create an enjoyable environment that everyone's happy to come to, because everyone's putting in the same amount of work, then people are going to be happy to come down and put those hours in that they need to. And we can't see it not being a great place to be part of.
Can I ask, how long did it take from someone having the idea of trying to offer children fee-free football to it actually becoming a realistic possibility?
Well, Ken, our president, has been, you know, a huge advocate of trying to keep our fees as minimal as possible. They obviously use the program over in New South Wales, I believe, the Dunbar Rovers, that do a scholarship. But they only do their scholarship for their NPL side. The rest of their clubs do have to pay the fees. So we kind of looked at that and went, well, that's not really what we're about. We're about everyone having that opportunity to play for free. So that's where it started. And then it would have been, we're looking at a good 4 months of meetings every Tuesday night after training for a few of us guys to really nut out how we were going to go about it. And it evolved from there, and everyone's been fantastic that's helped out. So it's been a great group effort so far.
Well, congratulations, I think, to everybody who's actually been part of that, because, A, you've obviously shown dedication over the 4 months, and it is a great program that you've come up with, so congratulations on that from me. What I wanted to also say is there's a lot of people are going to say, well, you may bring in these young players, you may uncover some diamonds, but there's always the possibility, with the division that you're in, that an NPL club's going to come knocking and steal those players. I mean, what's your feeling on that side of things?
Well, you can't escape that fact that is likely to happen. But what we want to do is we want to create that environment where kids can see the benefit and the parents can see the benefit of being involved in this club and not get taken for, I guess you could call it a ride, in terms of them paying huge fees that they don't see the benefit of. Why do kids have to pay $1,000 for their kid to play in an NPL club? I don't understand where that money goes. I mean, I'm fairly involved in football here at the club, so I can see where money goes, but it's definitely not to junior development, I don't think. So, look, they're always going to be there, but like I say, if we can create an environment that they can see the benefit, I don't think it'll become as much of an issue.
I would like to believe, maybe it's the romantic in me, that if you did in fact uncover a player that went on and, let's say, you know, even got a contract with the Glory, that he would never forget that you gave him that opportunity because you gave him fee-free football, and there will always be that bond and that loyalty throughout his life.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that would be the scenario that we're aiming for, is to get kids to the potential where they can. If they have the ability to play at a professional level, then that's exactly what we would like.
I mean, if you look again at the junior ranks these days, one of the things I do find sad is we have these trials, so what happens is we keep seeing children moving from club to club rather than staying their junior years with one club. Do you feel that the program that you're creating here is also going to create a little bit of loyalty that players will stay at Balga rather than moving on and rotating to other clubs?
100%. I mean, the whole trials, to me, doesn't make any sense. If you picked kids under 13's age, why are those kids not good enough to fill your under-14 side next year? Have you not developed them enough that you need to go find other players? And what happens to those players when they get knocked back from that club for the next year? You know, those kids, you know, what happens to them? They just disappear. I'm not sure, you know, I don't know what the stats would say, but I would say there would be a fair few that would not play football again. So, I think it's a great system. But, that's our aim, is to change that, is to provide that environment where kids want to stay with us long term.
So how are you going to determine which children you have in the numbers that you're going to have to cap off? Because, you know, I'm expecting you're going to get inundated with parents with children that want to play football, but you may not have enough places in your teams.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really is going to be a first choice scenario. We will be monitoring our website and our registrations that are online now, that are available to sign up. So people can sign up now and enroll for the fee-free football program. And then once we reach what we see as our limit, each age group, then we'll have to close it off.
And your website address, you might want to just tell listeners if they want to get in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. www.dalgasc.com.
Well, look, Gary, I think it's a fantastic thing that the club is doing. We wish you all the very best, and hopefully we can stay in touch and find out how it all pans out.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for your time.
I'm Azuma Nelson, and you are listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and that was Gary Shorto from Balga Soccer Club. If you want more information, go to their website. They do have information on the website, and Gary gave you that website address. And also, you can, of course, call the club. But I think this is a fantastic move. I know that, obviously, there's a few clubs are not happy with what they've done. But again, talking to someone just the last week, two children looking to try and play football. The fees were going to be, I think it was $1,400 per child. So $2,800 just for their children to play sport for one season. That is ridiculous.
Oh, it's totally ridiculous. What are they getting for their $1,400?
I don't know. I mean, the interesting thing, John, is there was a brilliant article written by somebody in America, and it actually mirrored Australia in that they have pushed their junior fees up in America. If you look again, they have no relegation from the Major League Soccer, as we don't have any relegation from the A-League, and they were going, is this why both nations are struggling to qualify for the World Cup? I think there is a correlation there, but again, conversation for another day, because it's your turn to take control of the mic.
Let's see, what am I going to tell you after that? There's a few things we could be having a chat about. What situation that's going on with the Western farce at the moment. It's just totally laughable, the stories that are coming out there. And I just get the feeling that there's something going on we're not being told about in relation to this proposed Pacific League. Wonder how long they really have been talking about this behind closed doors. But I'm going to have a crack today at Australian hockey. We're not relevant anymore, Ashley. Our sport is no longer relevant on the national stage. And I say this because the AHL was held last weekend here in Perth, or the weekend before, which you did a very fine job of commentating on, I must say, alongside Ashley Nelson. You two were great. And the coverage was overall was excellent. Fantastic to see it stream live as well. Easy to get hold of and watch. And there was some great hockey play. There was some really good hockey play. What there wasn't was any media coverage. And when I say any media coverage, I mean none. The ABC didn't feature it on Grandstand at any stage of that afternoon that the finals were being played. The Herald Sun in Melbourne on Monday morning had not one story about Victorian hockey winning both the men's and women's titles, with the men going back to back. The most, what's the word for it?
Parochial?
That's the one, parochial. The most parochial paper in the nation by a mile couldn't write a story somewhere in there about Victoria winning a national title in hockey.
The style, John, in which they won both games going to a shootout.
Exactly.
And the nerves, I mean, to me, the women's final was unbelievable.
Great
Georgia
game.
Nanskorn scoring with just 14 seconds left on the clock. And this was a player who the national coach previously said she didn't score enough goals from midfield. Well, as I said to her after the game, you can turn around now and say, look, I only score them when they're important.
Yes, that's a good point. But nothing. Where has our sport gone in the national psyche? I can remember as a kid watching the national championships live from Perth, as it was, on the Wacker ground. Rick Charlesworth was playing. It was chipping down with rain. It was a horrible wet day. And that was on the ABC, live. That was in the 70s, and we find ourselves now, 40 years later, and we can't even crack a mention in a newspaper. West Australian, on the Saturday the final started, the Saturday morning, nothing. Nothing. This is our hometown paper. This is the national finals are being held here in your hometown. Nothing. 6 pages of AFL trade news, but nothing about a national title being held in our state.
But let's also on that point, because I found that incredible, in that what you look at, though, is if, for example, the AIS does get relocated away from Perth, the West will be up in arms. They'll be going, oh, this is terrible. This is... But they have again, as we've said with the Western Force, they contributed to the demise of the Western Force by stopping giving them the coverage that they gave them at the beginning. And at the same time, the West has to have some sort of responsibility if the AIS moves, because they've had two national championships held here and they've given it next to no media coverage whatsoever. But the biggest problem, John, is the editors of these newspapers, because they no longer send the journalists out there to actually cover the sports. They sit behind a desk. If it's on TV, they do their match reports based on what they've watched on the TV. And I don't think the West, and I might be wrong, have sent a journalist to cover the Glorion and away game for a number of years now.
Now, that leads me on to the second point I was going to make about Australian hockey, and that is, what the hell are India and New Zealand doing in a national championship? Because I'll tell you, those very same sports editors would be sitting there going, why are we covering this? It's not a national championship. India and New Zealand are playing. It is not a national championship. And development teams, it's not even India, it's not the Indian national team. It's a development squad, same from New Zealand. Can't we have some sanctity about some things? A national championship should be a national championship, not an invitational tournament.
Yeah, that's a difficult one, because I tend to agree with you, exactly what you're saying, but they were trying, and I don't think they've done a good job, personally. The idea was to try and revamp some interest, and they thought the international teams may help raise the profile. What we've just said has proved that it hasn't done that. But the idea was memorandums of understanding were meant to include those teams. Let's not forget Malaysia were meant to also be there, but no invitation was received. Now, let me just put that in context. So initially, Malaysia were invited to the Australian Hockey League. Then the dates, at those original dates when the tournament was proposed, Malaysia could not play because they already had commitments for something else. I think it was the Southeast Asian Games. Anyway, then what happened was Australia moved the dates, and because Malaysia had already said no, they forgot to invite them the second time. So Malaysia were left out of the tournament. But no, that was the theory behind it, was they were going to try and grow and even rebrand the Australian Hockey League to make it something bigger, to make it something better, to make it something that was more appealing to television and the media. But I'd have to say, after 2 years, has that happened? I don't think so.
It's not appealing to the media because it's just another tournament. As soon as you add those overseas teams in, it's in their eyes, it's no longer a national championship. You know, it's not elite.
So now
it's
you're saying
the elite level
is
of
that then?
Hockey.
So now you're saying that's why they didn't give it coverage and it's okay. Because you're complaining that they're not giving them coverage, but now you're actually giving them an excuse as to why they didn't give it coverage.
No, I'm explaining their mindset behind why they didn't give it coverage. I'm not saying it's okay that they didn't give it coverage. It's terrible they didn't give it coverage. But in their thinking, they don't see it as a pinnacle of Australian hockey anymore, because it's a development tournament.
But you know, in India, every single one of those games got coverage in India, in the newspapers there. All the games that India played, how the competition was panning out, got coverage in the newspapers.
How do you reckon the Indians would feel if we sent an under-21 development team to play in their national championship?
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I don't know. I think they wouldn't... I actually don't think they would mind, to be honest.
What if they won?
I don't know. Yeah. Well, that would be another thing. But India didn't win here, did they?
No, they've twice made it to the semi-finals.
Exactly.
And were within a goal or two. In fact, they were within about 3 minutes of going into the final.
Yeah, and I mean, they had a dubious goal disallowed. Like, we still couldn't work out why that was disallowed.
And
that would have made it 3-0 at the time, so...
Which would have, that could just about close the door on the Victorians. Or the
New South Wales guys,
yep. Yeah. But they've got to have some sanctity about some things. There's all sorts of development tours go on all the time. You know, we have teams coming from overseas through Perth playing games and tournaments against other development teams or against the state team or even against the Australians all the time. We don't need to be inviting them in to compete in our national championship, inverted commas. This is the pinnacle of Australian hockey, and it should remain that way. You've got to build up some sort of gravitas about the event, give it something that's special. And by inviting these teams in from overseas, you lose that.
dare I throw something in the ring there based on this? It was something that I feel is, I think a lot of sports are guilty of, but I think hockey probably more than any, both internationally and domestically, is they don't market themselves very well. I mean, I've said this with the Hockey India League. The reason to me the Hockey India League has just basically gone down after the second year, third year, is because the only people that were marketing it was Star Sports, and a couple of franchises put a few posters up around their cities, but the marketing was non-existent. And it's like, this is what worries me with the Pro League. So they're going to launch, the FIH are going to launch this Pro League in January 2018 is when the first game is meant to be played. They need to be start marketing that 6 months out. They need to be starting marketing that in the July of next year, because you will lose in December. Everyone's focused on Christmas. So it's like, if you've got a book coming out that you want to sell at Christmas, if you do not have it in the bookshops and start marketing in October, any publisher will tell you to forget it, because you will miss the boat. So they have to do, if they're going to market this Pro League properly and get everybody on board in the 11 countries that are participating, they need to start marketing it. If they don't market it properly and they don't market it by then, it will die a death.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that goes. I have a feeling that it's not going to take the Australian government too long to get jack of the idea that they're supporting a sporting code and the head authority and body is walking away with all the money. That's going to be an interesting conversation that Hockey Australia is going to have, because whether you like it or not, the government is the main supporter of hockey in this country, and they're not going to keep supporting the sport if they're just piling money in for some overseas organisation to walk away with the cream. Although, having said that, look at how much money the AFFA's got out of the national government.
Absolutely. And that probably does it for today, I think, John. Always good to catch up, and no doubt we've got plenty to talk about next time around.
See you then.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.